Welcome to the Sportsman Drag Racing Legends podcast, brought to you by the Class Racing Podcast with Aaron and Chuck. I'm your host, Mike Delahanty, and I'll bring you stories and conversations with some of the true legends of stock, super stock, and modified sportsman drag racing. This podcast is sponsored by Race Tools Direct. Race Tools Direct was founded to be your choice for quality tools and products that have been carefully selected and thoroughly tested, both at the track and the shop, by racers for racers. To place an order, go to racetoolsdirect.com or call 440-941-8533. This is Season 1, Episode 5. Cal Method and his wife Marianne are likely the most successful husband and wife team in all of sportsman drag racing. Between them, they have 4 NHRA national event wins, 10 national event runner-ups, 32 division event wins, 26 division event runner-ups, and more than 200 national records. And Marianne won the 1995 TRW All-Star Stock Eliminator title. In his own words, Cal has been obsessed with stock and superstock racing since the mid-1960s. It was his experience at the 1966 Winter Nationals that created that obsession. And from that point on, he was completely focused on stock and superstock racing. Cal knew he could outwork and outthink his competitors, and that showed in his racing successes. Marianne seemed to be a natural racer from the first time she got behind the wheel of one of Cal's 66 Chevys just before the 1976 Winter Nationals. She was a fast learner, and at her first Winter Nationals, she went all the way to the quarterfinals. Cal and Marianne are a team, and their racing over the years reflects that. They've raced each other 4 times in the final round at division races, with each taking 2 wins. But neither was hesitant to do what was necessary to benefit the team. Now in his 70s, Cal Method continues to race. He's also serving as the teacher and mentor to his stepson and stepdaughter, both who are promising racers. Just a month ago, stepson Todd was the runner-up in Superstock at the Winter Nationals. This is the second episode in this series with Cal. This episode picks up in December 1983 as Cal makes the change from 283 low-class stockers to an A-stock automatic big block Camaro. Here's Cal.
So I took that money and I bought Joe Moore's A-stock automatic Camaro.
Okay.
And Marianne, I had her go back and get it. I was working a big job where I was a foreman on, and I couldn't leave.
I told
her, I said, well, you got to take the ramp truck and go back and get it.
Well, to Kentucky.
And in the middle of a blizzard, clear across the United States, she went back and got it, and she's coming home, she just crazy. I mean, when they loaded the car back there, it was like zero out, and we couldn't believe it. But she pulled up, he started loading the car, and he had a hell of a time getting it started to load it. Didn't offer to take her in the house or nothing, and just loaded the car, took the money, and said goodbye, and sent her on her way. By the time she got to Denver, why, she was just pretty much getting emotionally drained and scared.
Oh, I can imagine.
Everything.
Yeah.
I called Herm Chapman and his wife, and she went there. I think she spent a couple of days with them.
Great.
Then she decided, okay, I got to get back on the road. And she made it as far as Evanston, Wyoming, above the hill that goes down into Salt Lake. And
yep.
She called me and she said, I can't go down that hill. I just can't do it.
Right.
And so I'm going, God, what do I do now? So I finally remembered I had a cousin I hadn't seen in years. He's in the Air Force, and he was in Salt Lake City. So I finally called my sister and everything. I got a hold of him, and he went up top of the hill and got her and drove the truck down. And then she finally made it home. Just before Christmas. So that was quite a story.
Wow, I tell you, the stuff you guys have gone through, and especially Marianne.
Yeah, she's She's had quite some adventures.
Oh yeah.
But our eyes switched to the Camaro, and then she kept driving the 283 cars, and then I think it was about 86 or so, we decided to build another Camaro. And about that time, I went through a job change. It didn't work out too well. We tried to run the two Camaros for a couple of years, and then we just financially couldn't handle those two.
Right, both big black cars?
Yeah.
Okay.
We had sold the Chevelle wagon to Tony Janes. So anyhow, we wound up selling her Camaro to a guy in Finland. And then Tony said we could borrow the wagon back for her to run.
Right.
So we did that. Then probably around 89 or something like that, we sold the Chevelle wagon for Tony to a guy in Finland. Then I can't remember if we only ran the one car. We must have for a couple years, because I built the Nova in 93.
Okay.
I was initially planning on running it in B stick, and it was going to be my car, and she was going to take the Camaro. When I got it far enough along, I could sit in it. Back then, you had to run the bench seat in it.
Right, the bench seat, yeah.
The seat was so tall that I had to bend my head with the helmet on, and I said, well, this ain't going to work. I says, I guess we're going to put an automatic in here. It's going to be your car. So that's how she got the Nova at that time. When she got the Nova, that was about the time that two-steps started coming in.
Yeah.
And a lot of times what would happen in the old days is guys knew that if they could hang you out on the starting line, and if you were on the converter and stage, you had to, you know, be disciplined enough to keep the converter right there.
Mm-hmm.
The most inclinations was the longer you sat there, the harder you pushed down.
Yeah.
So you'd either red light or whatever. A lot of people knew that about her, and they would do that. Well, when we got the two steps, I mean, she started winning like crazy.
Yep.
That and then combined with, she really liked doing the chasing. It seemed like those two, between the two step and chasing, she really got good.
Yeah.
And then we wound up, we won, she won the division again, 90. Yeah,
okay.
She won the division championship in 81, 1990, 1992, and 1993.
Okay.
Then she's had 12 runner-ups. I think I've won like 36 divisionals. But then, like in 94, she got to the final at the national event in Seattle.
Right.
Red lighted, and I'm pretty sure she red lighted with a 499.
Oh, it was a pink light.
Yeah, and then the very next year she did the same thing. But in four she did the same thing, lost to Dustin Braun. Then the very next national event was Brainerd, and she went back there. In one, that was her first time winning Brainerd. Then in 95, she got the chance to go to the All-Stars and
yep.
be the representative, and they had opened Richmond, Virginia. That was a brand-new track, and they opened
right.
it. We decided to go there and then come back to Columbus.
Right.
So we went down there, and at that time, W.A. Lee and I had become real fast friends in the 70s.
Yeah.
And him and his wife met us down there at Virginia. We got hook up with them and stuff, and Marianne red lighted first round. And so she was devastated. And so then we come back to Columbus. She started winning rounds there, because we only took her car. At that time, you ran like three rounds or so of the main race before you ran the TRW race, and she was she won those, and she got in the TRW race. They had weather problems, and we ran that one like it was two to three to four hours between rounds.
Right.
And finally, I remember she won it. It was probably 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And we went over to the banquet tent, and we were the only ones there. Everybody else had already done their thing and stuff. But that was real big for us. And then later that year, we went back to Brainerd, and she won it again for the second year in a row. And then Brainerd again in 1996, she got to the final, and she red-lighted by 4 thousandths against Scotty Richardson. And when we ran right on with a zero.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, that was unbelievable, because we'd been to Brainerd a lot of years, and it would, that track just kicked our butt, and then all of a sudden it turned around. A funny story. One time you're talking about the stuff we did when we was going to Fremont back in the 80s when we had the Camaros, and I had a spare 375 motor that I hauled in the truck too, and we were on our way there, and we dropped a valve in the truck down in Northern California. And that was about 9:30 or so at night. I can remember Jocelyn Brothers came by, and they towed us into a implement dealer's parking lot there. I spent the night changing, putting the spare race car motor in the ramp truck. We got going about 8 o'clock the next morning and made it to the race. that was quite a deal. But we done a lot of stuff like that when we was towing over the years.
I got to believe all the miles you put on those things. And most of the time you were using a ramp truck and then a trailer behind it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was all through the 70s and 80s. That's pretty much what we did. We actually, it got down to, we were doing that up until the later 90s or so. We were going to the Winter Nationals, and I think we were going to Arizona to test first or something. We were going down through Nevada on Highway 93 there, and we got to Wells, Nevada, and we'd left after work, and
right.
I couldn't go any further, and I told Marianne, I says, you got to drive. I said, I can't do it. We had a sleeper on behind the cab of the truck, and I climbed the sleeper and went sound asleep. And we got outside of Wells, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 miles or maybe 20 miles. And I remember waking up, and there was snow flying over the hood of the ramp truck, and she was sound asleep on the steering wheel. And I can remember reaching around her and grabbing the wheel, and then she woke up, and she instinctively slammed on the brake, and I steered the truck. Thank God. I didn't know if we were right or left or where we was at. Anyhow, I turned it to the right, and we come back on the road, and it was like 2 inches of packed snow and ice, and it spun around in the middle of the road and stopped. And I'm going, oh, my God. You know, I can just see the cars laying all over the ditch and everything. And we get out, and we look at it, and the cars are fine. They were strapped down. They didn't move, but the trailer had come around and hit the side of the ramp truck, but it didn't do much damage. But the rear end was cocked a little bit in the truck. And so we're sitting there kind of getting our heads together looking at it. Out there in 93 where we were at, you can see for probably, 20 miles. Just dead straight and level. And I look down there, and I'm way down there. I said, I can see lights. I says, that's got to be a semi. I says, he ain't going to see us in time. He's going to hit us. And we got to get out of here. So I got in there, and I thought, we'll see if it'll move. And it would move, but the U-joint, of course, was cocked, but it would move. So just by luck would have it, we went about just 100 yards or so, and there was a bulldozer had graded a road off, and so we pulled in on that road. Then I got back and tried to straighten the rear end as much as I could by just kind of beating on it and loosening stuff up. And I finally got it to where I said, okay, we can go. We just can't go very fast. So we went till it got just about daylight, and we found a place to pull off down in Curry, Nevada, I think it was. And I had a come along with me, so I got under there and loosened it and squared the rear end up on it, went on our way. But we decided right then and there that I said, we got to get a motor home.
Right, yep.
And
this.
So after that, I decided to sell my car and help us get the motor home. So I sold my car to Jackie Alley. Then we bought a 96 Gulfstream motorhome at that time, and that's kind of when we went to one car and decided we'd do that. And then later on, I think it was like 2000 something or early 2000 there, I decided to build a 70 Camaro, and I built it. And the place where I worked, Apollo Sheet Metal, I talked them into building a stacker trailer for us. We built that, and then we did that a while, and then I sold that car to Bob Medeiros in Division One, got back to one car. We did that, and then I think it was 2011 or so, she just said, I'm done, I don't want to drive anymore. So I took over the driving duties again, and then we did that, I suppose it was probably 5 or 6 years ago now, by Dana House and Wes McGann. They had a Nova out of Phoenix,
mm-hmm.
and they had a bad split up. The car body was there for sale, and finally Dana talked to me out at the Phoenix race. He lowered it enough. I said, hey, hell, I'll buy it for that price. So I bought the body, and we come home and then put a motor in it, and he started running two cars then again and raced that. And I got in the early 90s, when Marianne was doing good at Brainerd, I got to know Johnny Deacom and his family real well, and Jeff Steele, and we got to be, Johnny and I were like best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so 15, when I was back there, Jerry Steele had just sold the shop after Jeff died of cancer there.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry finally sold the shop. Johnny had all the stuff out of the shop. Well, they had sold the Corvette with number two motor in it, and they had the number one motor there that Johnny had all the part and everything. And Johnny said, well, you know, he said, you could put that in one of the Novas and run GT class. And we got to figure it out with three or four different carburetors. We could run 13 different classes.
Okay. Yeah.
So I said, that sounds like a good deal, because we'd been running both cars in H automatic, and our boy Todd had started to drive, and we were always having trouble qualifying where we wouldn't get each other right away.
Yes.
And so I said, well, that sounds worth a try. And so Jerry sold me the motor for just practically nothing. We put it in the one Nova and run with a 250 or 327 combination, 65, and which isn't the best combination, but it worked. It'll run 5 or 6 or 7 under. And so we bought a couple of power glides to put in it, and with trans brakes, and I drove it a couple times, and I just couldn't get on the button deal. I foot brake for way too many years.
Yeah,
and
right.
The boy, we had built him a 70 bracket car, 70 Camaro bracket car, which was built just like a stock Eliminator car, and
mm-hmm.
he had done fairly good with it around here. He won a few times with it and stuff, and he had a trans brake in it, so he was used to the button, so we put him in there, and shit, he just loves it.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I guess your you're driving that car. And it's been real good. Him, and I think that's kind of what's kept me going and here the last few years is you know, the kids, both of them actually now are just working on the daughter. She had a 69 Nova she bought years ago, and she did, it was a kind of a show car, street car.
Yeah.
And she got to race it last year, and it was kind of funny because actually both the kids won their first Wally last year.
And, it continues.
Yeah, Todd, he won the Seattle points meet, and the girl, she won the sportsman bracket at Woodburn this year. But, and then the boy, he wound up getting runner-up at the Winter Nationals and Superstock this year. And so that, it's been good. It's, me and him, hey, we had a pretty rough when he was a teenager. I kicked him out of the house, and we didn't really see each other for quite a few years there. And then when he wanted to build that 70 Camaro, we kind of reconnected, and now the kids are just fantastic.
That's great to hear. That's great to hear. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Everything went.
So basically, then you and Marianne now are more on the sidelines now, and it's the next generation that's going to take over.
Well, I'm still driving the H stock automatic car, and
okay.
we converted his Camaro because I had a 402 left over, so converted it to a B and C car.
Okay.
And but we haven't ran it much. Tilburg's still working on the motor for it after we had some trouble with the first time. I don't know why we did that because we don't need another car, but we can't help ourselves. But yeah, I eventually the daughter, I let her drive the H stock automatic car for the first time in Yakima at a combo race last fall. She just done fantastic. I gave her a 2-page tablet with what to do on it, and by God, I couldn't believe it. I mean, she followed it to a T. She done really, really good.
How old is she?
She's 50.
Okay.
Then the boy's a year older.
Okay.
And he's a sheet metal worker.
And okay.
His only problem is he can't get off work, you know, as much as he'd like.
Oh, yeah.
But, like I told him, I said, job comes first. They're both good. She's pretty green still, so, but I will see. Eventually, my plan is, we'll probably put her in one car and him in the other. And we'll just do whatever, because I don't know how much longer that I want to drive, but I don't know. We'll see. Every time you do fairly decent way, you think, well, maybe I still know how to do this.
I tell you, it only takes a couple good rounds, but man, you're good for a long time after that.
Yeah. At the National Open in Tucson a couple weeks ago there, I got down to three cars, and I actually would have been in the final, but they misdialed me, and the lights were burned out on their scoreboard, and I couldn't tell for sure what the dial was, and I should have just stopped, but I didn't.
Yeah.
I wound up, I would have won the round if I'd had the right number, because I ran on with a three, and we had the same light.
Yep, okay.
But that, you know, that's kind of good, but the very next day they had the points meet, and I lost first round, so that just tells you you can go from hero to zero right away in this sport.
Yeah. Where you guys are located up there in the far corner of the country, it's really tough to do the kind of racing that you do
it costs so much money nowadays, you know, because every place we go, I mean, hell, basically our close tracks are 200, 250 miles, and they're spread out, you know. We've always had to travel a long ways to do it, you know, and that's kind of part, like now we're retired, so that's you know, it's not that big a deal. But before, it was drive all night and race and then get back and go to work.
Yeah, right.
You had to be pretty pretty obsessed with it to do a lot of the stuff we did. But, yeah, you know, that's what they keep talking about, you know, having stock superstock combo races. Like I tell them, I says, where we're at, you know, the tracks are too, you got to travel too much, and there's not enough racers out here. You know, we're not going to get enough people, racers, to pay the kind of purse you need to pay today. Because they keep looking at that deal they got in the Midwest, you know, like at Earlville and stuff, where they're paying, you know, $2,000 to $4,000 to win and stuff. It's like I told them, yeah, but I said, you know, last time I was there a couple years ago, I says we had 113 cars,
yeah,
and you know you can pay a good purse if you get that. It just, I mean, because what it costs to run one of these cars nowadays, I mean, you know, it's just, you can't just go out and play.
No, it's not like a bracket car, and yeah, everything's doesn't have a life like a bracket car. So, what's the closest track to you guys if you just want to go out and run or test?
Well, Walla Walla is an 8-mile track, decent miles. Then Yakima is it's about 85 miles, but Yakima, okay. Track really needs to be repaved and stuff. It's pretty hard on tires and shit.
Right.
And all they have is bracket stuff. Woodburn is 250 miles. Boise's about 275. Pacific Raceway's about 230 or so. Used to have Spokane, but it's deteriorated to such a rate that they don't really have anything for the last probably 10 years or so or thereabouts. That's what was good about us living here. We didn't have any close tracks, but I was always centrally located between all the major tracks.
Yeah.
Because, like, our best tracks are Boise and Woodburn. They're head and shoulders above every other track. I mean, they're both family-owned. They run them like a business. They do improvements to them all the time. They're really, really good, conscientious business owners, basically. They realize that it's a business, not a hobby.
Yeah, right.
And so they're really the best tracks by far.
I gotta believe you and Waldo's cross paths up there in that corner of the country in the division races and stuff. He seemed to be pretty tough back in his day.
Yeah. Jim was a lot of the time he ran Superstock in the 70s.
Yeah.
Because I actually helped him. I tubbed his car back in the day to put big tires on it.
Okay.
And then I remember when he came back to stock, I guess it was probably 1980 or so, with the green Fairlane, we were still on 7-inch tires. And I remember there was no line locks or anything in them days, and I remember he'd spin 99% of the time, and,
yeah.
So he wasn't really that consistent. And but I remember right, just like Marianne, when they got line locks, he got a whole bunch better. I mean, a lot better.
This is Mike. Hey, a quick correction here. What Cal meant to refer to was a two-step, not a line lock. That's two-step here. Thanks. Now, back to Cal.
But yeah, but he always had a fast car. His car was always very fast.
Now who else up there? I mean, clearly you want a heck of a lot of the divisions, but the divisional titles up there, but who else, you know, was...
Dave Wren was one of the one of the guys in 1966 when I got the yellow wagon. That fall, we went to Superior, Montana, and they had a drag strip on an old airport there. And Dave was from Missoula. Dave ran A-stock automatic with a wedge, and he was pretty fast, but not real fast. And then there was a couple guys that ran C-stock GTO and a C-stock 442 Oldsmobile, and they would battle it out for class, and whichever one of them won, they were fast enough to be fairly competitive in the Eliminator. But back in them days, they spotted you one car length per class there, because they didn't have clocks. Deer Park had clocks, but they didn't yet. And I can remember Dave Wren, he bent the valves in his car, and so he was sidelined. And I remember I waited through the cars. We got to the final. I raced the 442, and I remember they spotted me out there, so many car lengths for the class. And I remember letting the clutch out. And I mean, I'm going, oh my God, there's no traction out here.
Yeah.
And I took off, and I'm spinning. I'm going, oh shit. And I'm going through the gears, and I'm thinking, well, I turn around to look at him, and he's coming. And I remember I beat him by about probably a foot and a half. And I remember afterwards, Dave Wren come over to me. He says, you know, if I had to bet my valves, I'd have beat you. And I said, well, I says, no shit, Dave. I said, that one car length, that ain't. I said, come to Deer Park, and I'll beat you every time.
Yeah, right.
That was actually, at that time, that was my biggest win with that car.
Okay. All right.
But yeah, there was Dave Wren. Dave has more runner-ups at national event than anybody in NHRA and never won one.
Yeah.
I can't remember how many it is, but it is a bunch. And we were at Indy the year that Mancini had the 64 wedge cars, and they were in like Superstock C automatic or something. They were bad fast, and Chrysler just kind of put that combination out there.
This is Mike again. Hey, another quick correction requested by Cal. These 64 cars were 426 Hemi cars. Thanks. Now, back to Cal.
And I remember Dave was there, and he was just wading through everybody. And he got to the final and running Ronnie Sox, and Sox was wasting his time staging, basically, because Dave was just going to kick his butt. And Dave went up there, and he'd done a dry burnout. Then he backed up, and he'd done one more. And then they staged, and he hit the throttle, and he blew the drive shaft out.
Oh.
And I remember Bob Lane was with me back there at that time, and I remember talking to Bob, and I said, you know, I said, I can't imagine. I said, one of us got to ride with Dave. I said, he's just got to be emotionally, you know, just screwed up. And so we traveled, coming home, we traveled together. I remember I just couldn't believe. I thought, oh my God, that's just terrible. But there was Dave, and then of course Pete Cost. He's been around forever, and he was always tough. Then in the 70s, there was Paul Smith and Ted Rohde, and then Steve Hahn. Later on, he had him and a group of guys helping him. They became pretty.
Right, their small block Mopar stuff was so fast.
Yeah. Oh, there was a lot of guys back in the 70s days. Larry Peterson was pretty tough.
Yeah, he had cars like yours, three cars, right?
Yeah, we've made a, you know, that's kind of what's kept us in it for so many years has been the people we've met along the way. I mean, I've, like I said, W.A. Lee and I, we got to be just really good friends. And then Johnny and Jeff, you know, all of them, you know, people just about in every corner of the country. We know people that we don't consider friends and would do most anything for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's what keeps a lot of us going back to the race.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, it it really is.
Now, do you still, you know, you mentioned earlier about Tilburg doing your motors. I mean, for a while there, were you doing a lot of your own stuff or relying on others?
I done my own stuff, all of it, up until probably 2010 or so.
Okay.
Somewhere around 2010, 20, maybe 2012.
Okay.
And then I realized at that time, I got to know Bob and Charlene Gullett. We've been friends for years, and Bob went to Tilburg and was having him do his motors. We were running, I could tell Tilburg, he flat knew how to make horsepower. And at that time, that's kind of when stock was getting into the, you know, way beyond the acid porting and stuff like that. You had to have tools.
Yep.
To do this stuff. So I finally, like I told Marianne, I said, you know, this is crazy. I said, I can't keep up because I don't have the equipment, don't really have the know-how of what's going on in today's world. And so Bob kind of hooked me up with Brian, and I talked to him. And at that time, I was converting from the 396 to the 327 to try to cut my cost down some.
Yeah, right.
And, so I, you know, I figured out what it would cost me to build a 327. I called Brian. He told me, you know, a price, and he was only like $2,500 higher than me, and that included dyno and the motor and stuff.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, I told Marianne, I said, this is really humbling, because I said, after doing my own motors for almost 50 years, I said, buying a motor is just, that's hard to swallow, but I said it's a smart thing to do. So we did, and I've just been real, real happy with him ever since. I mean, it's just, to me, like I tell people, I said, hell, he's actually, in the long run, he's cheap.
Yeah.
I know the motors are atrocious nowadays, because, I mean, a complete small block's, you know, just under 20, and a big block's almost 30, but, you know, if you figure out all the parts you got to go with nowadays, I mean, it just costs one hell of a lot of money.
Yeah, not much difference to a super stock motor anymore, it seems like.
It isn't. It isn't. A lot of ways, you know, after you build the initial motor, it's almost cheaper.
Yeah.
But yeah. But all this stuff, I mean, you know, hell, a transmission nowadays costs more than I had in all my 283 wagons. I mean, it was just... that's what I don't know how, you know, if younger kids, if their parents or family members aren't in it to help them, I don't know how you would even get started racing nowadays. I mean, it's so expensive.
Right. Then chasing down all the old stuff, you know, the all the old parts and heads and stuff that are so hard to find. That's why the young people that are in it are into all the new stuff and, you know, like the power adder stuff and all the small tire stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's it's really, really, really hard to be, you know, if they don't have some attachment to class racing, why they won't go that route. That's what I keep telling the kids. I says, you know, I don't know how they're going to do it when we're not able to anymore.
Well, yeah, I know that's the thing. We look. I know when I walk through the staging lanes, it's more like an AARP convention.
Yeah, right. That's what we say. You know, the gray hairs of almost 90% of the people have gray hair. There's going to be, that's what I told people. I said, you know, there's going to be about a 10-year period here where, man, it's going to, you know, we're going to die off like flies, and it's really going to take a hit.
Right. So earlier, you mentioned, you talked about at the mile highs, I'm going to take it. That's probably your biggest disappointment. So,
by far.
So, what was one of your biggest wins, or one of your happiest moments?
I'd have to say probably the one that I really was the most excited about, and everything was Marianne winning Brainerd in '94 for the first time. That was just beyond great, because she had just red lighted at Seattle. I mean, I was devastated because she had a 499 in Seattle, and I was just devastated over that. And then she came right back and won Brainerd. So I'd have to say those were kind of a real low and a real high, all within 2 weeks.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's where that carried both of you for a long time.
Yeah. It really did. And, of course, we were just astonished that when she got to the final in Brainerd for the third year, you know, I was just going, this can't even be real. Then, like, Seattle, where she got to the final 2 years in a row, and then both times red-lighted by a little bit, that was pretty disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I got to believe as a husband and wife team, is there any husband and wife team that have done what you guys have done in any sports and racing?
I can't think of any that Dave and Judy Bortman, of course, they'd done pretty good for 2 or 3 years, but they were pretty short-lived. I can't say as I know of any of them that have been racing as long as we have, and I've been at it since 64, so it's, and then Mary Ann started, you know, in 76 driving, and but it's like I say, I was up until the early 80s there, I was really, really obsessed. That's all I thought about.
Well, it seemed to work for you pretty well.
Yeah, well, like I tell people, you know, back in the 70s, I could outwork people and outthink them, and, you know, up until the information age got so great and everybody, you know, got to know everything, and you could pick up your cell phone and, you know, like I tell people nowadays, you don't want to hear it, but somebody with a cell phone and a checkbook, they can beat you tomorrow.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
Like I tell them, when I started, you know, the very first place where you could get any information was Stalin Moroso.
You know,
when they joined up, that was then they start selling information and parts, and then them and Bob Duffy in those eras, you know, that's when things started opening up a little bit as far as the secrets of stuff. But before that, it was just impossible to, and you know, you had somebody that would help you, which was really hard to find back in those days. But even like, you know, learning the like clocks for years, you know, people didn't understand. I mean, most people didn't understand the, you know, running the big front tire. They didn't understand rollout and stuff like that. And that's, like I say, pretty much all through the 70s, you know, when we'd leave home, we pretty well could name at least the last 10 cars that would be, you know, around after a few rounds, because there were just a lot of people who just didn't know why they were bad. They had to figure it out.
So of those guys, you know, and you talked about the guys you can pretty much count who's going to be in the later rounds. Were you the guys that shared the stuff, or were the guys that you didn't want to know?
I would mostly help most people, even, you know, all through the 70s. I never been one to keep secrets. But, I would help people just because I wanted them to get into drag racing. And that's kind of, I guess, how I was raised. You know, you just, I don't mind helping anybody. And for the most part, you know, most of the drag racers are, you know, pretty good people.
On your 283 stuff, you were always setting records. What do you think it was that kept you always quicker and able to pick the car, but pick up the testing, or just...
I guess some of it was I would come home work, and I'd work in the garage till midnight every night. And then we did a lot, you know, a lot of, for those days, we done a lot of running. I mean, we would go run the cars because we could rent tracks for almost nothing. So I think that helped keep an edge on it. And then there's some people, you know, like Stahl and Duffy and Marv Ripes at A1.
Yeah.
They help me maintain a competitive edge over people that probably a lot of people just didn't talk or wouldn't know those guys, kind of like I did, because I just got to know a few of them over the years. And there was people just like Dave Renn. See, the reason Dave was such a competitor, him and Dave Koffel were real good friends.
Okay.
And Chrysler was so much further ahead in those days. If you've seen those Chrysler bulletins that they put out from the late 60s and 70s, it's just like, you know, a torque plate on a cylinder. They were way ahead of everybody else on that. And they would put out tech bulletins, but they would only go to their factory racers. And I know Dave shared some of that with me. And, I mean, my God, it was just amazing to me at how far they had, you know, how hard they worked on it with their engineers to give them an edge.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff like that I think I probably got that maybe other people didn't. And most of the other people, I would have to say, all with the exception of a few through the 70s, you know, they were racing. They didn't have the obsession and drive that I did. I mean, I was very hardcore. I mean, that's all I, you know, just eat, sleep, and breathe it.
Yep. I suspect the one time you had quite a few bodies parked out around the house somewhere.
Oh, yeah. At times, probably had six or seven at given times around it. It was a lot more fun back in those days because you could outwork somebody and outthink them.
Yep.
And I never really considered myself actually that good a driver, but I always thought I could beat somebody by outworking or outthinking them.
It's kind of like it's almost like the Glidden model, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like what Bob did, only he done it on a way grander scale, but that was kind of the mentality I had all through the 70s and stuff, and, you know, up until they started giving you all the information on your time ticket, well, I always felt like I had an edge.
Yeah.
But after that went away.
Yeah.
It's like nowadays, I mean, it's, I'm not a real good computer person. I don't have the computerized weather station and stuff and the crew chief program, and I know I should have it, and I know I need it, but I just hate it. I want to go to the track and have fun, not work.
Yeah.
But with all the information available, I mean, it's incredible how tight the racing has got. I mean, it amazes me that people can take a car and you go down there and, you know, you can run within 100, if not closer, every single run almost.
Yep, it's definitely changed.
Yeah, but it's still, you know, it's still fun. It's still our world, and I'll be glad when we get back to it here. I tell people, I said, I'm a Christian, I believe in God, and I believe God has looked after me more than I deserve by far, because almost every bad situation I've ever been in, whether it be work or drag racing or whatever, almost every bad thing has turned out to be a good thing, you know, after you got through it. And I don't feel like that is coincidence.
Yeah, I think he likes you. He gives you a lot of buy runs.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's been good. I can't complain. And then, I do know that over the years, setting the records through the 70s and 80s there when you got points for it, I know at one time we set over 200 national records between me and John McLaughlin and Mary Ann.
Wow.
Just because we were just setting them all the time because they were worth points.
That's a lot of head gaskets.
Yeah, it is. We tore it. Like I said, you know, I look back on things and I cannot believe how many teardowns I've been through and stuff. It's just, I think of it nowadays, these guys, they talk about wanting teardowns and stuff, and I thought, you know, there's no way I could go through what I did back then. I just physically couldn't do it. I look back on it and I think, wow, you know, I was really obsessed, because that's the only way you can look at it. I mean, if we had to go through some of the things we had to go through back then, I mean, people just can't even, I mean, because NHRA, you know, I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, I mean, they were God. I mean,
yeah.
You know, they, I remember many times going through the Winter Nationals when you'd have tech and then you'd have a reject line. And, you know, that's back when, I remember one year at the Winter Nationals when that little rubber strip that goes on top of your firewall where the hood comes down,
yeah.
You know, if you didn't have that, you didn't run.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
They let everybody, I mean, there was probably 40% of the field, if not more, that didn't have it, and they put us all over the reject line, and they finally, towards the end of the day, they said, well, you can go to the hardware store and get some rubber and put on there. I remember one time the guy from Canada that used to have a 69 Camaro convertible super stock car that Val Hedworth did the work on.
Yep.
I can remember they have an X frame, and they have a 8-inch steel plate that had it bolts to the bottom of that. And I remember that guy, they wouldn't let him run without it. And they searched all day, and they found one in L.A., and he finally got it and was able to race. And I'm thinking, boy, you know, it's just crazy. I mean, the stuff, all your trim had to be just exactly right. You know, everything. I mean, it was just, it's like I tell people, I say, you know, the day when, for, you know, it was just normal back in the day, farmer would come up, lay the book on the fender and figure out your class. And double check, make sure you had it figured out. And that was just, you know, the way it was. And it just, and, you know, whatever he said, I mean, he was basically God. I mean, there was no, it's like they talk about factoring and stuff. And like I said, I didn't like it in the day, but I almost think I'd take it over today's deal. But he'd lay his book on the fender and he might say, well, last week, decided you needed 5 horsepower, so this week.
It was a benevolent dictator versus the democracy we have now.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it was a dictatorship for sure. but I do remember though a couple things when I got kicked out of Denver later that year. I think when we were at the Nationals. We were at the Carcraft All-Star banquet, and
yep.
I remember going down the stairwell, and I met Leslie Lovett in the stairwell.
Right.
And, you know, he stopped me, and he said, well, we got talking about things, and he brought that up, and he said, well, he says, I got to tell you, he said, there was a lot of unhappy people at NHRA that happened to you. He said there was a lot of people who were very upset about that. And like I told him, I said, well, I appreciate that. And I said, doesn't change anything, but I said, it's nice to know there was some people that figured I got a raw deal.
and they cared.
Yeah, I sure did like him. He was a nice fellow.
So, I mean, the way things have gotten now, I mean, we've probably swung the pendulum pretty far now. I mean, not too much tech, and we're kind of on the honor system. And are we better off in any way for it, or is it kind of spoiled us?
The only thing that I see that disappoints me in the deal is that I've never been one. I don't care if you've got a cc less in your head, or if you've got a 2,000 lift in your cam that's over, that didn't help you beat me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care about that stuff. But I wish that they would police the electronics part of it, because there is so much stuff going on today that, you know, I just feel like NHRA doesn't have a clue. And I don't either, quite frankly. I'm just guessing. But
yeah.
I know stuff's out there. And, you know, it's kind of like I said, you know, if your mom tells you not to get in the cookie jar and then she leaves and goes to town, you're going to get in the cookie jar and get a cookie. And if you got access to that stuff that can help you, there's some people going to do it. I mean, I don't know how they can feel good after you're doing it, but I'm sure there probably is. But it just kind of bothers me that the NHRA won't do that. I remember I went to Danny and I said, Danny, I said, if I win 3 national events in a row and I come up and you say, park your car there, walk away, we're going to check all your wiring and everything, I said, I'd take it as a compliment.
Yeah.
But I says, you guys won't do that. And he more or less told me to get the hell out of there and go back to pits. And I'm going, wow, that's just crazy that they just don't care.
Yeah.
And that kind of disappoints me, but it's like these guys. So I don't think there's I really can't believe there's very many guys out there that are just blatantly cheating.
Mm-hmm.
I think the honor system, for the most part, it's got to be pretty good. I mean,
yeah.
You know, because most of the guys that are class racing, they'd have a hard time keeping secrets. I mean, because there's everybody kind of knows everything, and they know who's doing motors, you know, motor builders and shit like that. And nowadays, I mean, hardly anybody's doing their own stuff, so they're not, you know, they're not going to be cheating, you know, blatantly like a lot of people seem to think is going on.
Yeah.
Hell, that isn't. I don't believe that for a minute. I think people are, for the most part, trying to be honest.
Yeah.
And then there again, I think, you know, I'd have to believe that there's probably like me. I mean, you just can't do your own stuff anymore. I mean, not unless you just happen to own a machine shop or something, and then you got to have all the expensive tools to do it.
Yep, and it's you're right, and the dyno and all the other stuff.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's such a, like I say, technology is what's really killed us price-wise. I mean, we all want to go fast, and you know, it's like that Gene in Yakima. First time I walked into his shop there, and he'd cost money, how fast do you want to go? He had a big sign there, I'll never forget it. he's right.
All right, well, good. Anybody else, I mean, Wright, Stuffy, you know, who else? Was there anybody else that you, I mean, you want to at least tip your hat to in terms of people that kind of helped you along the way?
Oh, yeah. Bob and Sandy Majot out of Edmonton, Canada. I met Bob in 67 up there when I had won that points race with the 57. And he went on to build a 57 Stalker just because of me, and he's helped us over the years with financially a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And Doug and Vi Swanstrom were friends of ours in California that lived by Pomona, and they helped us some 1 year.
Right.
And we never have got a lot of financial help because I just never there was nobody that ever wanted to give me enough. I just felt like the fender on the car was worth more than a couple $100.
Yeah, right.
But it's done that. But we've had so many people that have helped us, Vice and just stuff like that over the years, that just way too many to even think.
Okay. Well, good. Anything else you want to pass on or share with? I tell you, it's amazing all the stuff, you know, the stuff you rattled off in terms of what you did and what it took to get there. And then, you know, just Marianne as well. I mean, the two of you combined have done an amazing career.
Yeah, I'll never forget that 1 year when I think it was, I don't remember if it was the year she was, she was in the championship hunt right up until when Jason Lyon won it. And 1 year in the 80s, I finished sixth. But I'll never forget, I think it was that year that she was chasing the championship when Jason won it. We were both in the top 10 going into the Seattle National event. And I can remember we met in like the third or fourth round. I think it was the fourth round. I told her, I said, you know, you got more points than I do. And I said, so, you know, I'm in a red light. I remember doing that. And I remember Mike Walters, who I knew pretty well.
Yeah.
And you know, he called me. He says, I can't believe you did that. He's like, how could you do that? And I said, hey, we're a team.
Yeah.
I says, you know, that was the best thing for the team. I says, that's just the way we've always raced. I said, that's a no-brainer.
Right.
I said, that's just the way it's got to be. He just couldn't get over that. I guess they just, I don't know. You know, I've seen a lot of husband and wife people that raced, and I haven't seen very many guys that support their wife like they should. they just don't seem to realize that you are a team.
Hey, so the question I was asking, I said, now, Marianne, which she has to be pretty good in terms of, you know, picking up what the car was doing, feedback to you, and dialing and stuff like that. How was she on that?
Yeah. She was pretty good at that. She always had a pretty good feel for it. When we were both running two cars, we would kind of talk about it and do it kind of together. Most of the time when we were running, why, I would just tell her what I thought, and she'd say, okay. And she would do that. I'll never forget one time at Las Vegas, in the mid-2000s or so, one time I went up to watch, you know, when they were running in stock, and she was back a ways, and I was over at the side of the tower, and I was watching, and I got so involved in watching, and next thing I know, she's pulling out. And I normally put the dial on, and she said she was over there under the tower, and she said there was a couple people standing there, and she said, well, you know, I got to put something on here. I don't know where Cal is. And they put a number on it, and she ran right on it. I told her, I said, see, you didn't need me.
Right. Right.
But most of the time I would, you know, dial it, but I would talk to her about it, see what she thought, most of the time she was just concentrating on doing the driving, and she was real good. We would always, you know, I was always kind of the nervous Nelly when she was getting down in later rounds and stuff. I remember when she won the world's finals there in 2000 or 2001, whatever it was, she won the world's finals by we were running Tom Watts, and he was a black guy that had a stick car, and he'd just kind of really had a whole bunch of luck getting to the final, and I told her, I said, you know, we should win this. And I kept telling her, I says, no, don't red light, but get a good light.
Right.
I remember later she told me, she's sitting in the car, you know, saying 20, 20, 20, I want a 20. And I think she got like a 28 or something. I'm going, wow. But yeah, I always considered her to be, she was better, I think, on the starting line than I was. I always felt like she was better there. But yeah, it's, you know, like I say, it's always been a team effort, everything we've ever done.
I suspect that makes the rides to and from the track a little more peaceful as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does.
That finishes episode 5 and wraps up the conversations with Cal Method. I hope you enjoyed these great stories from Cal. If you like these podcasts, please hit the heart button, and we welcome your comments on what you'd like to hear about in future episodes. Thanks for listening.